Good morning, church. Good morning. Wow, that was quite the opener. We want to welcome all those that may be watching online, wherever you're watching us from. Welcome to North Boulevard. We're glad to have those of you here in person, a great crowd this morning. And I'll just remind you that you've got a week. You have a week. I sent David Hunziker the following picture, and I said, hey, David, it's that time of year. Your classic flavors are back. Wild Clayberry, Tropical Drywall, Chalk Lovers, Plaster Surprise, Attic Citrus, and Tums. Hunzi's a big fan of the Sweethearts candies, and I just told him, you know, I'm more of a big fan of the Sweet Tart Hearts myself. We still have that battle, but you got a week left to get something for your significant other, and if you're looking for a last-minute gift, I have a rock I will sell you for a really, really good price. I'll make you a very special deal. But you may get a card. You may get a card from your children that look like this. Valentine's Day is cool. You are too. You can be better, but I like you. The people I love, Mom, Dad, Sean, Kate, Tyler, and Teddy Roosevelt. I forgot your name, from Walker. Very special. The second Valentine is for Miss Johnson. She is a great teacher. She is not on the Jedi Council, but she is great with the Force. Dear Mommy, I do not think I say this often, but I love you very, 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 okay, this is the last one, very much, and I've got a poem for you. Roses are red, just like your face when Dad eats our snack. Thank you, Mom, for making me food so I don't die. Mommy, I love you sometimes. Thank you so much for being my mom. If I had a different mom, I would punch her in the face and go find you. Mom and Dad, you're lucky you are alive. I love you very much. Roses are red, violets are red, everything is red. A rose is not a good symbol for love. Roses wilt. So I will not give you a rose or even flowers. Our love is forever. So here is a Nokia phone. And then finally, dear Ashley, would you please be my girlfriend? I like you a lot, yes, no, or maybe. Please put yes, no, or maybe. She's given her answer, but with a note here. I'm sorry, I already have a boyfriend, Kyle, but when we break up, you're my next choice. P.S., that'll probably be a month or two. It's Valentine's Day week, but I also want us to think this morning about our new series, and we're going to think about the book of Genesis a little differently than maybe you expected. I want us to think of the book of Genesis as the first lines of a Valentine, or more appropriately, a love letter from our Creator to His beloved. Valentine as a love letter, Genesis as a love letter. I don't want us to think about this morning as a science text or even a history text. I don't know that Genesis meant to answer 21st century science questions. If you came this morning thinking, great, we're doing Genesis 1, Skid's going to solve the dinosaur problem for us, I would say you've come to the wrong place. My job is to get you into a relationship with the one who one day can answer every question that you might have about the book of Genesis. There's my good cop-out answer. But we are going to explore some things. My mind is a little bit mushy because I've been reading and studying and listening and talking and having conversations. I feel like I've been cramming for final exams as I'm trying to figure out how to kick off a series that in itself is the kickoff of all kickoffs, the book of Genesis. And we're going to go into this series that some people have called the first five books of the Bible. One commentator actually said, it's kind of like the crazy relative in your family. You know you have to deal with them at holidays and maybe at Thanksgiving or Christmas. You're not really quite sure what to do with them, but you know they're a part of the family and they belong. I'm not making light of the first five books of the Bible, but to say that we often don't know what to do with these books. They're complicated. They're heavy to read through. In fact, if you love The Chosen, I would argue that if we made a mini-series on the book of Genesis, it would be rated such that none of our children could watch it. The book of Genesis is like the Jerry Springer show of the Bible, to use maybe a dated reference, but it's full of so many things we don't know what to do with, and yet, somebody else said, it's like watching Empire Strikes Back before watching Star Wars. If you watched Empire Strikes Back and had never seen Star Wars, you would know that Luke Skywalker and Han Solo and Princess Leia know each other. You would be able to see that they've got a story and a relationship, but you wouldn't exactly understand everything that follows because you've never seen the beginning. So we're going to start at the beginning. The best analogy that we could think of, especially after seeing the awesome intro that Megan and the team put together, was this comic book rack that I've had in my family for some time. I bought this years ago because it brought me such joy as a kid to get a dollar from my mom and to be able to go and pick out one or two comic books. And I would go and flip through the pages at the drugstore trying to figure out which one I wanted. Because in the comic books, whatever hero you followed, you're likely to see in at least one issue their origin story. The phrase origin story, we connect it even maybe to a kind of a comic book mentality. A story of how a character became who they are. There was a podcast I ran across in preparing for this sermon, the Overthinking It podcast. They say, we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. And they looked at origin stories. And so I found a large Venn diagram, and they said there's four T's that we can put together. A superhero becomes a hero because of technology, and they explain all of that, or because of training, or because of trauma, or because of treasury. And they include people like Little Orphan Annie and Scrooge McDuck in their list of superheroes, which I found to be amusing. But they then zoomed out and they said Bruce Wayne as Batman covers all four of those, and he is the quintessential origin story of superheroes. This was very involved. So then I thought about Marvel movies and most of the movie trilogies that a lot of the students I know enjoy. You guys know that at least in one scene of those movies, they're going to tell you how this person came to be the hero that they are. They're going to tell you their origin story. I made a list of some from my childhood that kind of still stand out because they're a little wild. The Atom. This is Ray Palmer. He happened to find a fragment of a white dwarf star in his backyard. Never mind the fact that a white dwarf has a mass roughly that of the sun and is insanely hot, but he picked it up and it gave him superpowers. And, you know, we just go with it. Or maybe there's Kid Flash. Barry Allen, who is the Flash, was in a police laboratory when a bolt of lightning struck a rack of chemicals and gave him super speed. He was taking Wally West through the similar police laboratory when, once again, a bolt of lightning struck and the same thing happened. Very creative. Or you have the Wiz, who received a transfusion of mongoose blood to cure being bit by a cobra, and he mysteriously gave him super speed. Or Squirrel Girl, an actual Marvel hero. Looks kind of like Carol Burnett, if you ask me, if you're of a certain age. But Doreen Green, she was had an unspecified genetic mutation that gave her squirrel-like traits, enhanced agility, sharp claws, and the ability to communicate with squirrels. But she actually once defeated Dr. Doom, Thanos, and Galactus. For all of you comic book nerds, that's probably pretty impressive. And she partnered with Iron Man for a short time. But my favorite was this one. Chuck Tane was a courier for a scientist who was delivering a new experimental superplastic fluid to the Science Council. He got distracted by a robot fight exhibition at a local arena, as one does. And when he accidentally drank it, thinking it was his soda, and it transformed him into something that could expand, and he became Bouncing Boy and had some actual heroes and was a DC comic superstar for a while. But the origin story that really captivated my childhood was that of Bruce Banner, or on the TV show, he was known as David Banner. Most of you remember the 1970s show, The Incredible Hulk. Dr. Banner received an accidental dose of gamma radiation that altered his body chemistry. And then whenever he was angry or outraged, the show would begin with the word anger, would zoom out to reveal a flashing light that said danger. And whenever he was outraged, a startling metamorphosis occurred and he would become the Incredible Hulk. I didn't put a picture up because I thought it might be a bit much for young eyes. Now my brother is 7 years younger than me. Some of you met him. He's helped me teach from time to time. He does a lot of great teaching online. He's a Bible scholar in his own right. But when he was much younger, when we were children, my brother loved superheroes. Here he is as Clark Kent changing into Superman. Here he is as He-Man, which may be the nerdiest picture ever taken because Star Trek is playing on the background. I've told my brother, this may be the pinnacle of nerdiness. And I told Kelvin, how odd is it? What church do you think has probably had a He-Man reference 2 weeks in a row from two different people? But there's my brother as He-Man. But his favorite was the Incredible Hulk. One particular day, he cut up his Sunday shirt with scissors while my mom was out getting some milk at the store. She came back to see him in front of the mirror flexing, and she said, "Paul Andrew Skidmore, what have you done?" True story, my brother put his foot up on the toilet. He quoted the line from the beginning of the show when he said, "Look, lady, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry." Spoiler alert, she got angry. There was some anger, and it's a story that our family loves to tell because we were fascinated by heroes. So I got online and I thought, I wonder what my origin story would be if I were a hero. I found a website that allowed me to do that. You clicked on, you picked an element and then your environment that you prefer, your approach to problem solving, how do you prefer to spend your free time, how do you express creativity, 10 other questions. You entered it all in, hit the button, and church, I'll show you the superhero. It made up a name, made up a whole backstory. Apparently my Marvel superpower and superhero name is the Soul Blade. The ability to manifest and manipulate ethereal blades of energy that reveal and amplify the true emotions of those around him. David discovered his powers while penning a novel on the beach where a mystical wave infused him with insight. He now wields his soul blades to help others navigate their emotional struggles, breaking down barriers with humor and wisdom while protecting his serene coastal home. This sounds like youth ministry, but way more awesome. Then I took it a step further. My family was like, just stop while you're ahead. I went to ChatGPT and said, I need a comic book cover of me as the Soul Blade. And they said, well, tell me about yourself. So I said, I'm a white 54-year-old youth minister. That's all I gave it. That's all the information I gave it. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I present me as the Soul Blade. Yeah, you can better believe there's a poster of that going up in the filling station somewhere. And so there it is. Now, I realize you're like, so what's the point of this? I want to couch us in the idea of the purpose of origin stories. When Marvel released one of their hits, Black Panther, several years ago, the movie begins with a voice. The screen is completely dark, and a voice says, Baba, tell me a story. Baba, the African word for father. And he says, what story, my child? And he says, tell me the story of home. And in 1 minute and 50 seconds, we learn about the world where a vibranium comet lands in the continent of Africa and in the fictional nation of Wakanda, and how the first Black Panther rises to power when he discovers a magic herb, and how the tribes began to war together, and how they developed technology because of the material in this comet, and they've hidden themselves from the rest of the world. They tell that whole story in a minute and 50 seconds, and then they begin the movie. Now I realize some of you have seen the movie, some of you could care less about where we're going here, so now I want to kind of make the connection that origin stories do something. What do origin stories do? They tell us the main character. They tell us who the main character is. They tell us what went wrong. And then they tell us what is at stake. And the main thing that an origin story in a comic, in a movie, or on the pages of your Bible tell you is why everything that follows is extremely important. And if you don't understand the beginning, you won't have an appreciation for what happens in Revelation when all things are made new again. So we have to wrestle with Genesis. Origin stories, they shape us. They tell us how we came to be, where we've been, where we're going. They inspire us. They give us purpose. They give us direction. They give us community. Or they invite us. They invite us into a bigger story, and they take us from nothing into something. How does Peter Parker, a teenager, become Spider-Man? Somebody that is kind of literally a nobody into somebody that is quite important. From nothing into something. And that's where we find the first pages of our Bible in the book of Genesis as we open up our origin story. In Genesis, we find the origins of the universe, the origins of earth, the origins of man and of marriage, the origin story of sin and of death and of sacrifice, of civilization, of language, of government, and even the nation of Israel. Every bit of these origin stories are covered in this one book, in these 50 chapters, many in the first two. You open up your Bible and you find a verse that most people who've even not stepped foot in a church could at least quote. This one simple sentence, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim vehet haaretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In fact, this word, Bereshit, is the word that means beginning, and it's the name of the book of Genesis for the Hebrews. And so this word that means beginning is where we start this series and this journey. So Herbert Spencer was a 19th century philosopher, atheist, and he, in his landmark work called First Principles, he said everything that we know falls into one of five categories of the knowable. And he said, I'm not concerned with things that seem supernatural or invisible, but the things that are knowable. And he put them into these five categories: time, force, action, space, and matter. Now, again, I realize this is a little academic, and it's way even above my head. A lot of research, a lot of reading, and yet when I came across this and I realized, okay, Spencer says that time refers to the dimension something happens, the force or its cause, the action, its process, space is the environment, and matter is the substance. You don't have to understand it or be able to kind of walk through it, but I just want you to get those words in your mind, because it's interesting that many commentators will say, how fascinating is it that we look at the first pages of Scripture, and in just this sentence, I mean, how many words is this? In the beginning, we have time. Then God, we have the force. Created, we have the action. The heavens, we have space. And the earth, we have matter. Everything included in one sentence. The author who puts Genesis together says, I want to describe what's happening at the beginning. Now, I don't think that Genesis is meant to answer a lot of modern scientific questions. Teens will often ask lots of questions about Genesis or about creation. And this morning, I want to try to couch Genesis in a little different way. The author goes on to say, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. In first service, I gave a shout out to Kelvin's son, Joshua Teemer. Joshua, last week, came up to me and said, Skid, hey, I just want to congratulate you on 25 years at North Boulevard. That's really exciting. I mean, you were here before anybody was around. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, I mean, all the people. I said, are you talking about I was here before anybody in the youth group now was born? That's true. Or are you talking about the earth was formless and empty and darkness was over the surface of the deep? And he said, oh, no, am I going to get mentioned next week? I said, you just might. And so he just shook his hand out and he said, congratulations. This is the beginning. This phrase, formless and empty, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, I'm not a language scholar, but one of my favorite Hebrew phrases is this phrase, tohu vavohu, spelled maybe a couple of different ways depending on where you look, but tohu vavohu is a word that means empty and chaotic. This is describes the state of the earth in this passage. And darkness was over the surface, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. This word hovering is a word that would be very paternal. It would be a word that describes the mother bird over the nest and hovering over the nest. So you have images of a God who is protecting and warming and waking and waiting. The language is very, very poetic. And then we have the phrase, God said. He speaks into existence with a word. It's important that we remember that God speaks through his word. We'll come back to that in a minute. Let there be light, and there was light. Now, we have magic words. Our magic words, we think of abracadabra. Now, at least one author, Irwin McManus, said in a book on communicating, this phrase abracadabra, we think, has its early roots in connection to a Hebrew phrase, abracadabri, which is a word, a phrase, that means, I will create as I speak. And so anybody who teaches, this is helpful for anybody that teaches or anybody that speaks, whether you're a teacher in a classroom or a coach, or a parent who's nurturing a child, when you speak, you are creating. Why? Because you're made in the image of a creator who gave you creative power to also create with your words. Genesis 1 continues, God saw that the light was good. Now, I'm not trying to make a language comment here, but I want us to think about the fact that it's not that he just saw it and goes, oh, that's good, but he saw to it that it was good. If I ask Sean to do something for me and Sean says, I will see to it that that gets done, and then I said, hey, that got done, Sean saw that it got done. Jesus saw that the light was good. It was going to be good. And then it says he separated the light from the darkness. Well, you're like, well, how long did that take? What's going on here? Give us a timeline. I'm not going to answer those questions. I can't answer those questions. And a lot of us are divided on those. I would argue that on every pew, maybe on every side of the room, maybe even in your own home, there are people that would say, well, I think what we're about to see took this long, and I think that it took this long. And I would just lovingly argue, one, there was only a triune of witnesses that were at the first event. And there's going to be a lot of us around at the ending. So I'm going to spend most of my time focusing about what's going to happen at the end. It's fun to discuss the beginning. But I don't think that any fundamental doctrine of Scripture is really affected by how you put a timeline of these events. And there's not just one or two choices. There's multiple choices. It's fun to think about. I just don't think Genesis is trying to answer that question. Genesis is not trying to say how and when did God create. It's just trying to establish that he created. And this is what I would tell our students. So when a student comes to me and says, Skid, Revelation is a pretty big book. help me understand it. I'm like, well, it's going to be a longer conversation. And I'm not even sure I can help you. But what I can tell you is, let's summarize Revelation. God's team wins. You've got to pick a team. Don't be dumb when you pick your team. That's the point of Revelation. And there's a lot of other fun stuff to explore. So what's the message of Genesis? I'll tell a student, here's the message of Genesis. Because I had a student that came to me about 10 years ago, sat across from me, and he said, Skid, I wanted to meet with you. I want to let you know I don't believe in God anymore. And I said, okay, do you want to believe? And you've heard me before say this, perhaps. He stumbled through that answer to that question. Well, if he had said, well, yeah, of course I want to believe. That's why I'm meeting with you. Why would I have called you to say I didn't believe if I didn't want to believe? But when a student says I'm not sure that I want to believe, or they can't answer the question, then I know it's another reason. The answer that he gave me, he was like, I just don't believe that God created the world in 6 24-hour days. And that was kind of his way out of belief in God. And I said, well, good news is, I don't think the Bible really asks you to believe that. We talked some more about that. And then he kind of came up with another reason that had to deal with maybe some sickness of a family member and how he can't reconcile that with a loving God. I said, well, now you're into the second objection. And my guess is we're looking at the third objection, which is there's some behavioral pre-commitments that you've decided you want to live your life in such a way that you don't need there to be a creator, because if there's no creator, then you can live the way you want to live. So I said, let's look at the big idea of Genesis. If you hear nothing else that I've said, you can write this down, and then you have my permission, like Sean said, to go out and buy some snacks from the Super Bowl fundraiser and then come back if you want. This is the biggie, at least for me. The big idea is that Genesis lets us know that God says, I'm a God who brings order from chaos, and I'm a God who separates light from darkness. And he says, that's what I do. That is good news to a 13-year-old who's dealing with chaos in their family. That's good news to a spouse who's dealing with some chaos or darkness in their marriage. That can be good news to an addict who's trying to watch their life spin out of control and try to figure it out. And in God's love letter, he says, let's make it very clear who the main character is in the story. Let's make it very clear what is at stake. And let's make it very clear, if you don't get this right, everything else that follows is going to go badly for you. God brings order from chaos, and he separates light from darkness. John would also pick this up. In fact, if you were to ask people on the streets of Murfreesboro what books of the Bible mention the phrase in the beginning, what book starts with in the beginning, 99.9% of people would say the book of Genesis. But some Bible scholars, specifically those who've been through our study on John in the 10th grade every year, they would say, the Gospel of John. In fact, John goes even back further than the Genesis beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it or understood it. Light and darkness, they're going to be big for John. In fact, he records Jesus saying in John 8, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Jesus says, I separate light from darkness. The Sermon on the Mount, let's separate light from darkness. The last pages of Revelation, an eternal separation of light from darkness. In fact, there's no more sun. We don't need the sun, because God is going to be our light, and there will be no more darkness. Paul writes to the church in Corinth, and he says, for God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. One commentator said, Genesis is making a statement that we need an outside light source to be able to guide us and to govern us. And the New Testament makes the same claim through Jesus. We need an outside light source to guide us and to govern us. The problem with the Enlightenment is that we tried to put reason and all the answers for all of life's issues and problems into the heart of man. And Genesis makes the statement that we need an external source of light. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning the first day. Now this is where we begin to get confusing. We don't know how much time takes place between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, let alone Genesis 1:1 and 1:5. We can debate it, we can talk about it, we can feel differently about it, and we can coexist with maybe different interpretations. But one author that has helped me at least think about this is John Lennox. I wrote down some qualifications. John Lennox is a mathematician, bioethicist, lay theologian. He debated Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, many of the new atheists. He has a doctorate from Cambridge, a second doctorate from Oxford, and a doctorate from Cardiff. He is fluent in English, Russian, French, Spanish, and German, and he is a grandfather. Besides being a Christ follower, that's the only thing the two of us have in common. Gerald Coggin showed me a picture of him and John Lennox a couple of years back where he got to sit and have lunch with him. I was insanely jealous in the godliest way. And I said, oh, wow. And Gerald said, we talked about everything from the beginning of the earth to the end times to artificial intelligence. He said it was an incredible conversation. And John Lennox wrote a book that was very helpful for me. We just purchased this to put it in our library. It's called 7 Days That Divide the World. It's less than 200 pages. It's a small book. It'll challenge and stretch your thinking, but I would invite you, a lot of the questions and the debates that we could have spent time, you realize we could spend 52 Sundays just looking at a sermon on Genesis chapter 1, and 2 or 3 weeks just on the first verse of Genesis chapter 1. Lennox says this, it's one thing to wrestle with the meaning of the days of Genesis, it is another to understand, apply, and live the whole message of Genesis. And if we're not doing the latter, I'm not sure the former will profit us much. He says, Richard Dawkins' simplistic insistence on choosing either science or God is on the same foolish level as insisting that we choose between Henry Ford and the car production line to explain the origin of a Ford Galaxy. We go on in the text of Genesis. We're going to go quickly through some of the passages that you know to get again to a larger 30,000-foot viewpoint. God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the vault, and he separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was so. And he called the vault sky, and here we have the second day. And God said, let the water appear under the sky to be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. And it was so. And he called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And he saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. We could spend an entire sermon just looking at the phrase according to their kinds and its implication. But we continue to move on. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark sacred times. This is on the fourth day, and a lot of people, of course, will say, how can we have had regular days when the sun doesn't appear until day four? There's plenty of arguments both ways of what this could be saying. But again, I just don't think that that is the question that we should really spend most of our time debating. God is not making a statement of science, but making a statement, I think, of religion, I mean, of a relationship. And so then God makes the wild animals. We continue on. God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish and the livestock and all the creatures along the ground. We're going to pause for just a second here with this idea. God created mankind in his own image, and in the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Jesus will quote this passage in the Old Testament. So Jesus obviously felt strongly about Genesis. We know that. Now, I'm going to show you a quote. I want to apologize in advance. I know it's hard to wade through, and intellectually it's like being on a roller coaster. But just bear with me, because I think this is at least important to consider. John Lennox says, notice that on day 3 and on day 6, God speaks twice. This surely deliberate repetition is a clear indicator that according to Genesis, you cross neither the gulf between non-life and life, nor the gulf between animals and human beings by unguided natural processes. God has to speak his creative word in both instances. Without God speaking, there is unbridgeable discontinuity. The image of God in man was not produced as a result of blind matter fumbling its way through a myriad different permutations. Thus, Genesis challenges atheism's fundamental assertion that human life has appeared without the activity of God's mind, so there can be nothing special about human beings. I am tempted to add that it looks as if the writer of Genesis foresaw the contemporary debate. I realize there's a lot there, and I know that you're like, I'm going to have to ponder that. That's all I'm going to give you is things to sit and think about. God speaks twice on those days to separate us from those things and to say that you have value and you have worth. You are God's special creation. An easy way to word it to a seventh grader was, if God has a refrigerator, your picture is on it. And so we continue. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. God gives them all of the plants of the earth to tend and to care for. Thus, the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. 630 words is all we get to describe the meaning of the beginning of everything. It's like the minute and 50 seconds of the Black Panther. We cover the whole thing in a few words. By the seventh day, God had finished. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Now, we zip through those, you're like, wait, we could have spent a week with each of those days. Of course we could have. But I want you to notice the verbs that describe the actions of God in Genesis 1. God speaks, he sees, he divides, he makes, he sets, he places, he names, and he rests. These are all the things that God does in Genesis 1. If we're made in his image, he says, then these are the things that I've put into you and given you the power to do in the lives of other people in the kingdom. This is the account of the heavens and the earth, when they were created, when the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. There's a more detailed, nuanced account of creation in Genesis 2. We don't have time to unpack it. But I noticed that when he says this word when, it's actually a Hebrew phrase that means in the day that God created, which further complicates our understanding of just the word day and the usage of the word day. But the idea is not about a timeline. It is about a purpose. Somebody else that's helped me to think about this more deeply is Dr. Hugh Ross, astrophysicist and believer. Pretty outspoken believer. He spoke at MTSU a couple of years ago. I took my discipleship group at the time to go and hear him give a talk called The Cosmic Reasons to Believe in Christ. His question and answer with skeptics in the audience was as powerful as his lecture. Each one lasted about an hour. He's got a video that's testing Genesis with science. I took our discipleship group, I explained to him about our happy face, and I said, could you make our happy face pose? And he was a little concerned, but decided, okay, you know what, I'm going to go for it, and had a great time talking to our students. Michael Bowen, one of the students in the picture afterwards, we were processing it over dinner, and I said, so what'd you think? And Michael said, well, I did not understand a lot of what he said. And he said, he is smarter than any of us will ever be. He said, but if somebody that brilliant, who knows that much about the universe, believes that God created it all, then that is going to be good enough for me for right now. Ross has written a book called Navigating Genesis. Now, he's going to say some things that are going to stretch your thinking, and probably some things that maybe you don't agree with, but these are all sources that have helped me to understand. Now, an atheist, Christopher Stringer, of the Natural Museum of London, even himself admitted, the study of human origin seems to be a field in which each discovery raises the debate to a more sophisticated level of uncertainty. Oh, you think? I'm going to show you one more quote. It's going to cause some people to, it's a lot to take in, but it's one of my favorites. And it's one that I have to wrestle with. In fact, I think we even have it on the bulletin board in the filling station, because it's one of those quotes that I want people to read. C.S. Lewis said this, it's awfully small, you may not be able to read it, so just listen to it. Supposing there was no intelligence behind the universe, no creative mind. In that case, nobody designed my brain for the purpose of thinking. It's merely that when the atoms inside my skull happen for physical or chemical reasons to arrange themselves in a certain way, this gives me as a byproduct the sensation I call thought. But if so, how can I trust my own thinking to be true? It's like upsetting a milk jug and hoping that the way it splashes itself will give you a map of London. But if I can't trust my own thinking, of course I can't trust the arguments leading to atheism, and therefore I have no reason to be an atheist or anything else. Unless I believe in God, I cannot believe in thought. So I can never use thought to disbelieve in God. I know it's mind spinning, but minds like Ross, Lewis, or Lennox challenge me to think about this, which is why the proverb writer says, it's the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings is to search out a matter. Church, this is what we're doing. We're spending time every week searching out a matter that a lot is going to remain hidden. Here, I think, is the problem for the young man that I sat with 10 years ago who said, I don't believe in God. Because if you accept Genesis, you have a creator. And if you accept a creator, the Bible goes on to describe you have a lawgiver and a judge. It was the lawgiver and judge that I think he did not want to believe in, and so he had to find a way to dismiss the fact that there was a creator. My roommate in college was a physics major with a 4.0, saw my Bible the first day I moved in August of 1989, and he pointed to the Bible and he said, oh, are you one of those? I said, one of what? He goes, one of those. I said, a Bible? He said, no, somebody that believes in the Bible. And I said, yes, I happen to be someone who believes in the Bible. He said, okay, fine. He said, I'm a physics major. I got a 4.0. I know enough about the universe I have to believe that there is an intelligent design behind it. And I even believe there's a creator. I just don't believe he cares. He wound it up. He set the clock ticking. It's going to wind down. It's going to ring. And we're going to be done. That's what I believe. You can pray for me all you want. Just never tell me about it. That was his speech to me. I did pray for him. We studied. He eventually came to Bible studies. He's now a believer. He and his wife attend a church in Atlanta. And we spent a lot of time talking about this fact. But I said, it can't be that God just wound it up, because the rest of Genesis is about God profoundly interacting with his creatures in relationship. He's not a distant God who wound it up and then left. What we don't have time to fully unpack this day is what happens then in Genesis 2. The Lord plants a garden in the east, and there he put the man he had formed. The Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing. And then he puts here at in the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The Lord God took the man and put him in the garden to work it. And he said to him, "You're free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For when you eat from it, you will certainly die." One other author that's helped my thinking on such things, Tim Keller, pastor in New York that passed away 2 years ago from pancreatic cancer. Tim Keller wrote a book called The Reason for God. I'd recommend it as one of the five foundational books in my life that helped form my faith. But at the time of his death, he was doing a video series called Discovering the Gospel in Every Book of the Bible. He started with Genesis, got midway through the Old Testament before he passed away. But they're 10-minute videos. They're incredible. And he talks about how does Genesis, like every other book, point us to the gospel? And he says the book of Genesis fundamentally asks this question: am I going to trust God's definition of good and evil? He said, at its core, this is the question that Genesis is posing for us. And then he says, Genesis tells us a story of several people, but they all point to Jesus. In fact, Jesus is the greater Abraham who leaves his home and heads out for a place that he does not know. Jesus does this as the greater Abraham. Jesus is the greater Isaac who offers his life. Isaac is spared. Jesus dies. Joseph. Jesus is the greater Joseph. Joseph, we're going to read later on when we get down into the series of Genesis, that Joseph is rejected by his brothers and then rises to power. Jesus is the greater Joseph. Keller says that the point of Genesis is not to answer a lot of scientific questions, but to point us to the fact that that all of these things point to Jesus. We read about all these characters in the Faith Hall of Fame. You're familiar, church, with this verse. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and the assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. But do you know the second verse of Hebrews 11? By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. Matthew quotes Genesis when he says, "Have you not read that from the beginning the Creator made them male and female?" Jesus is going to quote Genesis. In fact, Genesis is quoted 200 plus times in the New Testament. One last reference from the New Testament. John records the prayer of Jesus in the garden. And notice what he says. He says, "Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am and to see my glory, the glory you have given me because you loved me before the creation of the world." So, as we kind of bring this full circle, I want to come back to the comic books. I can only think about this on a level like this before my brain gets tired, and I have to put it in words that maybe I can understand, especially working with students. And so when I would go to the comic book rack, the way I decided which comic book was I going to pick up is I would pick one up and I would look at the picture that was on the front of that particular comic book, because there was always a cool picture that drew you in. And on the cover, it had three elements. There was a hero, there was a predicament, and then there was a question. And the question was, does he or she have what it takes to get out of this mess that they're in? That's why I would spend my money to find out how the story was going to end. Is Spider-Man going to possibly get out of this mess? Oh no, Superman can't fly. Iron Man's tied to a rocket. That looks dangerous. Robin can't handle the Christmas tree. This is crazy. My favorite was always Aquaman. He was always my go-to because he was kind of an underdog and nobody really liked Aquaman, so he was the one I picked. But on every cover of almost every comic, he's the one that is always in the most trouble. Even when he's fighting a starfish, he's the one that for some reason is having the most difficult time. Here's Aquaman again. There he is in the clutches of the robot. Everybody else is doing fine, not Aquaman. Aquaman here is being carried away by this woman, and everybody else seems to be just fine. But in every comic book, you have that. There's a hero and a predicament and then that question. So let me take you to the cover of your comic book. Or more specifically, my grandson was down here. In case y'all didn't know, I'm a grandfather. Cannon was down here. I was talking to him on the front row during the baby dedication, and I was just like calling his name. We made eye contact, and I thought, this is his origin story. Let's imagine now that he's on the cover of a comic book, and one day Cannon is going to be 13 or 14 years old. Some of you may be his camp counselors or even his youth minister or chaperones. Some of you are going to be the ones that will be sitting across at a table saying, my life is in chaos and there's darkness in my life and I don't know what to do. I'm in a predicament and I don't know if I have what it takes to get out of this mess that I'm in. And I want you to be able to point him to the words of Genesis, not to explain how long creation took, but to say, Cannon, you need to know that we serve a God who brings order from chaos, and it's a God who separates light from darkness. That's what I want you to be ready to tell him. See, in Genesis 1 and 2, we read that God caused us. But the rest of this series from Genesis 3 through chapter 50 is going to be that God called us. And the origin story, he gives us purpose. A personal story as we close. Some of you know I've taken a group for 20 years plus to Camp Shiloh. Many of you have been. Some of you have been as counselors. Some of you worked there. Some of you have been to Shiloh and have built prayer shelters or cabins or cooked or done laundry. Some of you have been on mission teams. About 10 years ago, a story happened that I witnessed. I didn't have my camera, so I kind of had to recreate it with those involved. This is a young kid whose name is Omar. Again, this was 10 years ago. I have no idea where Omar is. I've never seen him after this week of camp. But Omar showed up one day with this wrapped around his neck. And I thought, it's a particularly warm day. Like, why was he wearing this? And I said, Omar, why do you have something tied around your neck? And he said, because I'm a hero. And I said, okay, fair enough. Great. He wore that around the entire day, and he walked around, and he just kept walking around. People say, why are you wearing that? He'd say, because I'm a hero. Aaron, his camp counselor, came up and said, hey, man, no, you can't wear that. And I was like, oh, come on, let the kid be a hero. He said, no, that's a sidekick cape. You got on a sidekick cape, man. You got it. You're a hero. I'm going to get you a hero cape. He went back to his cabin and brought him this large, awesome, brightly colored towel, and he tied it around Omar. And Omar, I remember, even though I've recreated these pictures here, Omar's face just lit up when he put this on, and he began to run around, and he said, look, everybody, I'm a real hero. And I told Aaron, I said, Aaron, like, why'd you do that? And he said, because this is a kid that has been made to feel like he is nobody. He said, and I want him to realize that he's not a sidekick, that he's a hero. See, on that day, forget what you want to say about all the complications of the book of Genesis. Aaron took it to heart and he said, I'm going to give this kid an origin story that is going to take him from nothing and is going to make something out of him. And he said, my job at Camp Shiloh, he said, simply Skid, Aaron's a very quiet guy. He said, my job is to just turn sidekicks into heroes. And I've never forgotten that. Because Aaron understood that origin stories, they shape us, they inspire us, and they invite us. And when you tell your origin story, when you sit across from somebody and say, let me tell you when my life was chaotic and disordered and in darkness and how I was brought to light, when you sit and tell that story, we call it your testimony. It's your origin story. But it begins with Genesis and the big idea that God brings order from chaos and he separates light from darkness. And so on December the 24th of 1968, couple of years before I was born, but many of you will remember it well. The Apollo 8 mission circled the moon several times. Astronauts Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and Frank Borman tried to decide what challenge and greeting were they going to give the people of Earth on Christmas Eve. Now, 1968 was a very turbulent time in our nation's history, and the news headlines were dark and chaotic, tohu bavohu personified. And they had several drafts of speeches, and some of them sounded just too corny or too cheesy, and some of them just didn't sound like they hit right. And finally, one of the astronauts suggested, what if we just open the first page of the Bible and we read Genesis 1? How many of you in the audience remember watching that event live? Some of you were there and remember as the astronauts took turn reading from this text, which is actually in the Chicago Aeronautics Museum, along with the flight plan for Apollo 8. This, if you zoomed in, is the entire text of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And they read as 1 billion people on our planet listened to this story being read. And next year, the U.S. Postal Service created a stamp. And so every Valentine card in 1969, many of them likely had a stamp in the corner that told this story, in the beginning, God. See, Genesis is not a history book, it's a love letter. And it's a love letter that is written to separate light from darkness. And God gives us a picture I've shown you before, maybe last February, the Heart Nebula, 7,500 light years away, and it's 200 light years across. This is 5.8 trillion miles away, so large we can't possibly conceive of its size. And God says, I've put this here quite possibly as a way just to say, I want to communicate my love to you. And the reason the earth is, the universe is so big, is because I think God needs to have a place to be able to contain his love and vastness and greatness for us. And so, church, we end this like we do every Sunday with a simple invitation like that letter that the first grader sent to his friend. I want to be in a relationship with you. Yes, no, maybe. A lot of us have probably circled no. Some are trying to decide maybe. And like the kid that I sat across from, I don't want to believe in a creator because I don't want a lawgiver and a judge. What I would invite you to do this morning is to give serious thought to saying yes to King Jesus, the one who separates light from darkness and brings order out of your chaos. And you'll have a chance to do that after we commemorate the life of Jesus with communion. It's not within my power to place the divine teachings of God directly into the heart of another person. All I can do is lay them on the surface of your heart so that when your heart breaks, which it will, these things will be the first to fall in. If that's happened in any way this morning, may God and God alone receive all the glory. Let us stand and let us sing, church.